At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's have a nice cup of TRE in the afternoon with Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Carl Gorham. He's an award-winning TV, radio writer and musician. His new book, My Life in a Garden, is a poignant and funny chronicle of the complex nature of grief and of falling in love after loss. It's the true story of a widowed dad and his unique relationship with his garden. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be on.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. And what a great idea for a book. I love how you've kind of joined these subjects together. And I want to ask you, first of all, about gardening, because you haven't always had the same relationship with gardening, have you? It's not something you've always enjoyed.
No. And I come from a very urban background. So it's not as if I was ever really steeped in nature. It's not in my blood. You know, I was brought up in town and cities, and it's something I've had to get into later in life. My parents were much more into going to galleries and castles, and we never went on nature rambles, and indeed we didn't even have pets. So I'm very much a latecomer, and I've struggled with it a little bit. But in some senses, coming to it later has been that much more rewarding, I suppose, because, you know, I've come into the joys of it quite late in life, and it's been a big discovery.
Yeah. And how has gardening helped you with your journey through grief? What's been the connection there?
Well, I think that probably the biggest single thing I've learned about nature is the kind of restorative and sustaining power of nature. And for me, as someone who's always done a lot of stuff and been very busy, the ability to be in nature and just to kind of stop, if you like, to just be there, is perhaps the single biggest discovery, not just through my journey through bereavement, but really right through the book, through all kinds of twists and turns in my life. It's a kind of like a mindful thing, I suppose, to appreciate the strength and permanence. And I think in these days when everything's very fast moving and fractured, we're looking more and more and needing more and more something to sustain us, something to sort of cling on to. And there's nothing more permanent than nature. It's been here for thousands of years and it'll be here long after we've gone. So I think that's the kind of biggest single discovery, really.
Yeah. And I know you've made a connection in the book between tending and nurturing a new relationship in the same way that one takes care of the garden. Tell us about that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it's all about putting in the effort. You have to nurture, you have to be patient, you have to build up that relationship, I suppose. And every relationship and every bit of gardening goes through challenges and difficult times. And that's what I've certainly found, actually being out in the garden, is that it's not all plain sailing. Sometimes you hit all kinds of unexpected difficulties, and it's about how you react to those things. And how much you keep your eye on the prize, and you keep your eye on the longer term, if you like, and trust that over time, the more you put in, the more you'll get out, that experience will teach you a lot.
Yes. There's been some really lovely quotes from various people who have read the book, that it's interesting seeing people's reactions, and a lot of people have enjoyed the book, having maybe not gone through grief and lost a partner, and also not really enjoying gardening necessarily themselves, which is really nice. David Baddiel saying, funny and beautiful, and I hate gardening.
Well, that was that was particularly nice because although it obviously is about gardening in many ways and about your relationship to nature, I didn't want it to be exclusively just for those people. I mean, you always really want to have a wide appeal, and it's nice that he recognised that, and it's nice that it can say something to people who perhaps, you know, aren't deeply into nature and don't go out in their backyard every weekend. So I think the sort of, I always hope to draw broader lessons, if you like, draw broader life lessons about things like, you know, investing your time in something, you know, nurturing over a period, learning. The whole thing about learning in life, I think, is a really important thing, whether it's learning about nature or learning about anything. You always hope that there are bigger truths that come out of what you're writing, and I think that sort of quote is a nice sort of recognition that I might be along the right lines.
Yeah, definitely. And also the, I guess, metaphors for life and loss that we can have in our gardens, connecting us to memory and nostalgia, and but also obviously new life and new relationships. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a bit in the book where I talk about meeting my current partner many years ago, and about the fact that in that situation, the garden almost sort of played Cupid, because my very first date was when I invited her and her children round on her birthday, effectively. Our daughters were in the same class at school, and I took the opportunity to invite Emma and her children round, and it was as if the garden was, like I say, sort of playing the romantic sort of get it together of us, if you like. And we strolled around the garden, and I was kind of aware of what power it had, because when I, with my late wife, bought the house and garden, it was the garden that had first stunned us and attracted us. And we'd seen so many possibilities of living this new outdoor life in the garden that I think in some way, almost subconsciously, or maybe it was quite conscious, I wanted to try and impress Emma. And I thought the best way to do that is that let's stroll around the garden. And I recall actually doing, there's sort of things where you, as you're speaking, you're thinking, am I really saying this, and very, being very, sort of ramping it up by talking about my grandiose plans, how I was going to have a sculpture park in the garden. I mean, I was going to have jazz festivals and all kinds of stuff, which I'd never been able to be able to achieve. But it was, I mean, it was a very spectacular space. You know, you're talking about, it was 3 acres, but it wasn't just any 3 acres. It had a beach maze in one corner that you could actually get lost in. It had a Victorian chalk quarry in the middle with kind of tropical day of the triffid type plants lining it that you could get lost in. It had 47 trees. It had 9 lawns. It was really, really spectacular. So yes, and it worked, because I'm still with Emma years
Brilliant.
On. So yes.
Lovely. Yeah. And what was the relationship with your garden different when your wife was alive? Did you really make the most of your garden together?
In a sense, you could say, you know, the reason we got it, it was a product of circumstances. My wife was diagnosed with cancer in 1998, and she had initially successful treatment, and we were living in London with a kind of two up, two down 40-foot garden. But over a period of a few years, the cancer came back, and we got into a cycle of her having treatment and the cancer coming back, and et cetera, until it got to the point where we knew that if the cancer came back, it kind of wasn't going to go away again. Mm. So I think in that situation, you're into a different gear where you're doing all the things that you ever dreamt of. So we went traveling, we went to America, we went to Australia, all over Europe. And in the midst of that, we saw this spectacular house and garden, and we just went for it, because that's what you do. You, in a sense, you don't stop to think about a lot of practicalities you might otherwise think of. And we saw in it, I suppose, a kind of, I don't know if you know the book Swallows and Amazons, that kind of outdoor idyllic dream of, we had a 6-year-old daughter, of her running free with her friends, of us lighting fires underneath the stars, of parties, of barbecues, of growing some of our own vegetables and becoming a bit more self-sufficient. All of those things, I think, we saw in that possibility in that moment. So in a sense, I think getting this spectacular garden was very much a leap of faith, and it's one that at another time we might not have made. So it is a sort of very intimately tied up with the dreams that I shared with my late wife, I suppose. Yes, that is very true.
Yes. And were you able to do a lot of those things or not?
We did. We had, we didn't have long together. We had 18 months, basically, this new house and garden, but we had some fantastic memories that we built. We got some wonderful sort of photographs and video of the times we had there. We had lots of people to stay. We had friends up virtually every weekend, and it was a glorious time, even amongst the fact that, you know, it was a very difficult and challenging time, obviously, as well.
Yeah, amazing how nature can, I don't mean help necessarily, but I mean maybe it can help you through real dark and difficult times.
Yeah, and it can be an inspiration, and I think in that situation it's about, you know, there's a great urgency to grab the moment, to really feel that you're living very fully. And I think that nature is so glorious, especially a space like we had, is so glorious because it was colourful. You know, it smelt fabulous, the flowers, the shrubs. The weather was particularly good, I remember, ironically, for the last 18 months. And, you know, when you're in there, you think it can't get any better than this. This feels like we are living our dream, if you like.
Yeah. And I guess on dark and difficult days, something like a new flower blooming or something can really make you smile and, you know,
yes,
give you a nice moment.
Yeah. And I remember as well, particularly birdsong, because we had so many trees, the dawn chorus was quite extraordinary. And I have memories of getting up very early with my late wife and just walking around the garden and just standing there at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning in the middle of summer, just listening. And I can just picture her just looking at me and smiling as this incredible chorus of birds. I mean, not just a few birds, I mean, loads and loads of them, a cacophony of lovely sound. So those sorts of memories are very precious as well.
Yes. And was it strange going back over some of those emotions to write this book? I know it's a lot about the garden, but
yes.
You do talk about grief and the fact that you're happy with someone else, which is really wonderful. Mm. Was it strange sort of reliving some of those moments?
It's bound to be poignant, you know, and I think one of the things I've learned about grief is that it's always with you. You know, you move forward in life and that's a good and positive thing, but you never, you take your bereavement with you. I think I use the phrase in the book, bereavement is a passport that you must take with you to every destination. And I think that's quite a good way of encapsulating the fact that no matter where you are in the world or, you know, how far you travel away from it, it's always there with you in some shape or form. So I think it was quite emotional at times, but again, I kind of expected that. And you sort of live, say, parallel lives. My experience of bereavement is that you suffer this terrific loss and you go through different phases. I mean, the first year for me was, I would characterize as shock, really. And it's very much living day to day, getting through, you know, I've got to do these tasks. I've got to look after my daughter. It's kind of head down. And then, you know, there are different phases after that. There was the one where I found myself effectively sticking my head above the parapet and you start to think, I could be this, I could be that, I could do this, I could do that. And you actually, I point out in the book, you do have these slightly bonkers, say, fantasies about what you could become. You know, you suddenly think, oh, I could be a sculptor in Berlin. You know, in my case, in the book, I discovered some onions in the garden and I thought I was going to become an onion magnate, you know, like the king of onions in East Anglia.
Brilliant.
Failed dismally, ruined
go?
The whole crop. Dreadfully, absolutely dreadfully, because I didn't know anything about onions, but I got very excited wanted. I brought this huge crop into the house. I wrapped them up in newspaper and I didn't know what to do with them, but I thought, oh, something will occur. But then nothing did occur, obviously, because I didn't really know what I was doing. And then I got quite annoyed with them because they were literally everywhere. They were in the kitchen, they were in the hallway, they were in my bedroom.
Oh, I bet it stank. Well,
he did. Well, initially, it was a nice smell. It was a nice sort of onion hum. But then I sort of blanked them after a while because they got quite annoying. And also I couldn't find anything because I'd emptied all these receptacles and filled them with onions. And then, of course, after a few weeks, I blanked them completely. I thought, I'm just going to ignore them. They went off. I opened one of the newspaper things and it was just like nuclear waste. And I had to throw the whole lot away. So that, and of course, then I felt terrible because I thought, oh, you failed as a farmer, you failed the dream and all that kind of stuff. But that was an example, I think, more of where I'd got to with my grief, which was that it was different to the way it had been before. But I was in this new phase where I was, and I think a lot of people find this, where you're trying to, when I say remake yourself, because I think you imagine that if you become something else, you know, whether it's, say, onion magnate of East Anglia or whatever, then you can put more distance between yourself and whatever it is that you've suffered. Yeah. Whereas the reality is that's a bit of a myth. You know, it's always going to be there with you and you're slightly conning yourself, but it's definitely a phase. And you're quite vulnerable to these snatching at ideas, trying things out because you think, oh, that will change everything. That'll make me feel different. You know, like I say, I mean, my yardstick was always, oh, I could be a sculptor in Berlin. And why I particularly thought that, but you know, I could move away from everything and then I'll feel differently. And it's coming to terms with the fact that you'll always be a bereaved person. You can live a very happy life. You can have new relationships, but there will always be that part of you. And that's the acceptance part that takes a while to get to, that you have to learn about, I think.
But it's a lovely phase, I think, that idea of anything's possible. I think a lot of people can identify with maybe going through a phase like that, even when they're not bereaved. But yes, I mean, going through the stages of grief, where you feel like there's no hope, or you know, who am I without this person, and what's the point of life, and you know, that's a very sad place to be, but a very natural and normal place to be at a particular stage. But to then suddenly think, right, what can I do with my life? Where can I go? What can I do? It's a really wonderful stage, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a lot of things. It makes you very vulnerable because you are prone to, you know, as I say, so to taking things up and putting them down and having wild ideas that aren't very practical. But it's also a kind of an encouraging sign that you are moving through the phases, that you are progressing with your grief, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's important. It's important that you change over time. Like I say, you don't leave it behind, you bring it with you, but the nature of it changes.
Yeah.
It looks different to you. I think that's the key.
And also it's, I guess, taking some kind of control back. You know, when you're grieving, I think a lot of it you can feel like something has happened to you, which was out of your control. There's nothing you could have done about it and you've just got to cope with it and deal with it. But then suddenly taking back that control in your life and making decisions of what you want to do now is a really positive step.
It is, and it is that thing about actually when you do things, you start to live again outside of the grief as well. You know, even if you're making daft decisions, and you're trying to be a sculptor, you're making terrible sculpture in Berlin. You are. That's a bit of new life. That's a new thing. You know, that's a new chapter, and I think it's about opening more and more new chapters. You may not find the right one for you. It might not be the right fit, but it's about. It's about doing that. That's what life is about.
Yeah, giving it a go.
Giving it a go, yeah. And you know, failure is not a bad thing. It doesn't matter. It's the doing that's important. It's the trying, if you like.
Mm. So
I think it's when you, sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, I think it's when people get stuck in their grief, that's quite a difficult thing.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to some people and they say, yeah, you know, it was tricky because I felt like I was basically just going round and round and round in the same thing. And with these phases, I find it quite difficult because there's no real, people talk about the phase of grief, like it's very measured and you do so many weeks with this one. And it's very confusing because actually the timescales are very different for everyone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you bounce back to something that you think you'd left behind ages ago.
Yeah.
So it's not a linear progression. So that's what makes it quite exhausting, I think, as well, is that you think, oh, no, I've been here before. Oh no, and I'm feeling like I did a year ago. Oh, no. And even when you think you're on one track, you can have bad days, bad hours. You know, years on, I'm still capable of things knocking me sideways, even for a few minutes. You know, it can be hearing a song, it can be seeing a shrub, it can be, you know, looking at gardens and thinking, oh, I remember when we did that in our garden. Mm. So you never lose that completely, that ability to be taken back, I think.
Yes, but lovely to have a supportive and understanding partner.
Yes, absolutely. And amazing too, because she was a widow herself.
Oh, wow, okay.
So she had lost her husband 2 years before me. So obviously there's I say pros and cons in terms of the fact that she understood so much of what I was going through and I understood a lot of what she was going through. But there are also different challenges as well. And I talk in the book about the things that widows and widowers, when they get together, have to deal with that are different to, for instance, you know, people who get divorced. You don't have the ever-present sort of living baggage of someone down the road, if you like, but you have a different thing and you have that issue, I think, that you can sometimes feel that the person who's deceased can no longer do any wrong, as in, you know, you tend to put them on a pedestal and that can put pressure on a current partner. And there's a chapter where I talk about this and how you have to deal with this and work through that. And I think we were both aware of it, which was a big help. You know, it's that phrase, the dead can do no wrong. They're etched in time, you know. Your memories are perfect. So I think that's a challenge in itself.
Yes, absolutely. And what's your relationship like with your garden now?
My relationship with the garden is lovely. We downsized eventually. We moved to a much smaller garden that is much, much more manageable. Now, I think my relationship with nature as a whole has changed to the degree where I think I say somewhere that, you know, actually being in nature or going for a walk or something like that is as much a part of my day as writing and breathing. You know, it's very important to me now in a way that it wasn't a few years ago. And what's nice about, because I'm surrounded by a beautiful countryside, I live up in North Norfolk near the coast, is that now obviously I can go for a lovely walk along the cliff tops and not look around and worry about the state of the grass or the fact, oh, God, that tree needs pruning. It's a different level of involvement. It's being in it. It's doing that mindful thing that I spoke about earlier, but it's not having, if you like, the cares and worries of trying to maintain a garden, especially one that's from the book that's that big, because it was a hell of a lot of work.
Yes, it's got to be fun and enjoyable. Once it becomes a chore and a job,
yes, it was a phase of life as well. And, you know, I'm very, very honoured and privileged to have had that fantastic garden. But it felt like it belonged to a certain phase when my daughter was growing up. And I'm glad it was there. And I don't now hanker after it. I'm just pleased I did it.
And
you move on. It's like in life, you know, I'm in my early 60s now. You know, you have a different outlook on what you need from an outside space, a garden, the kind of size that you want to have. And I'm lucky enough to have that. It's a lovely garden. It's just much more manageable.
Yeah, perfect. Well, if people want to get a copy of My Life in a Garden, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Carl Gorham, who we've been chatting with today. Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. all that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.